Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Apologize if there's a little bit of hiss in the background, a little bit of background noise. I've got the heater blaring because it's officially bloody cold in Melbourne. I've just gotten home from a gig, went out with my bandmates and we watched a couple of bands. And I got home and the house is freezing, so I've got to have the heater blasting to warm the place up. Alright, in today's episode, we will be discussing Book 3, Chapter 7 of The Brothers Karamazov, and then we'll be reading Book 3, Chapter 8 of The Brothers Karamazov. Let me just get my, my window open here while my computer loads. There it is. Come on, computer, do the computing of the thing. Alright, so the questions that I asked you guys about Book 3, Chapter 7 were these. What was all this talk about? Sorry. Did the prisoner do the right thing, dying instead of renouncing Christ? And what did you think of this chapter? Did you have a favourite bit? A little bit vague questions, but the chapter did sort of wash over me a little bit, so I feel like I maybe didn't take in as much as I could have, so I left the questions a bit vague in the hope that the answers might help me wrap my head around it. Jordanzi said the reference to the moving the mountain with a grain of faith is in Matthew 17:20, and Jesus said unto them, because you of your unbelief, for verily I say unto you, if ye have faith as a grain of mustard seed, ye shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Just some quick googling. I definitely have below average knowledge of Bible stories. The way I read it, either Smerdyakov is just trying to get a rise out of Grigory, or Dostoevsky is intentionally making Smerdyakov parrot a very weak atheistic argument for purposes we'll see later. Smerdyakov seems to say, the Bible says that if you have faith, you can literally move mountains. No one is actually able to move mountains, except maybe two people living in an Egyptian desert somewhere. If the soldier in the story didn't renounce his faith in the face of torture and instead commanded a mountain to squash his tormentor, the mountain wouldn't actually move and his faith would then be shaken anyway. Essentially, Smerdyakov's argument is that if you take all the words of the Bible in their most literal sense, your faith will quickly fall apart. When Jesus says, have faith and you can do anything, and then I try to move a mountain, it doesn't work. Therefore, either it's false or I'm not really a successful Christian. I'll be interested to see where this goes in future chapters, but I doubt Dostoevsky will let this go as a legitimate atheistic argument. Most theists would argue that there is at least some interpretation involved in biblical stories, and that no, Jesus wasn't promising everyone superpowers. I think either Smerdyakov knows this and is just poking fun at Grigory, or Dostoevsky will later show Smerdyakov's reading to be as simplistic and unpersuasive. Tekrific said, Dostoevsky intentionally making Smerdyakov parrot a weak atheistic argument. I think you may have hit the nail on the head. I am Norwegian said, I enjoyed the podcast today. The improved mood shows. Smiley face. Thank you, I am Norwegian. I appreciate you saying that, and it's good to hear. I know my mood was a bit bad. for a little while there. Even actually casting my mind back through Wuthering Heights was a little bit sour mood there as well. So yeah, I don't know, maybe that's been stirring for a little while. I suppose you just go through times, don't you? You moods go up and down. I've got to say, like, Wuthering Heights I didn't love that book. Same with, actually, Dubliners, I didn't love. And now this one, it's kind of growing on me, but I'm not you know, head over heels for it. And I think it might have just been a bad choice of three books in a row that didn't exactly excite me. So, I don't know. But I am excited to keep going. And I'm not going to give up on Karamazov. I really want to keep reading it. I just hope that it starts to sink in a little bit more. Anyway, thanks for saying that I'm Norwegian. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. I Am Norwegian also said, Smurdy's first smile happens right after Fyodor talks of taking a dead man's skin to a monastery, really hitting those psychopath notes. What was your favourite bit? You know, I really loved Gregory muttering Supermaker as an insult to Smurdy. It's such a goofy jab. Oh, I have the hiccups now. And what was all the religious talk about? I Am Norwegian said, I don't blame you for getting confused here. While I think I know what they were talking about, I found myself getting lost in Smurdy's logic, which I assume might have been some of the point. He was toying with Gregory's faith. But the subject of the soldier and the Christian thing do in that situation is... Sorry, the Christian thing to do in that situation is very much a real question of some depth to it. They are discussing something like the importance of consistency on several levels, both in action and thought. In Japan during the Tokugawa Shogunate, there were attempts to stamp out Christianity in Japan. Japan was insular, to the point where it would be several hundred years before they opened their ports up to foreigners. But missionaries still found their way in and had some success in spreading the good word. They started the persecution by simply executing Christians, but they quickly discovered that this only makes martyrs, elevating and justifying the killed into something that only created more followers. Plus, figuring out who the Christians were was difficult, requiring home inspections, trying to find Christian symbols or icons, but these could be hidden. Their next strategy was much simpler and more insidious, the practice of fumi-e. Fumi-e means stepping on picture. They would place a stone carving of Jesus or the Virgin Mary at your feet and tell you to trample it. And that was all it took to weed out the Christians. Consider even Zosima, the ascetic. The only thing he owned was Christian icons. Even Alyosha's story essentially starts with his mother's interaction with a Christian icon. The struggle these people, Christians, went through is beautifully portrayed in the movie Silence. I've brought it up once before, and now it's surprisingly much more relevant than the last time. It brings up the question of if it's possible to act in dissonance with your beliefs and come out the other side clean. There's a big focus on truth in Christianity. This combined with the fact that a representation of Christ is not just a rock with the image of Christ on it, but a physical pointer to Christ, and a way for them to express love and devotion, and it suddenly becomes difficult to simply trample the image. This is easier to conceptualize with a cross. It's not just something that looks like a T to Christians, it's a powerful symbol. Though the fact that the test was as simple as trample on his image, it was enough to know the status of one's faith should impart the significance on its own. There's a lot here I don't understand myself, and I lack the theological language to really nail down what I'm trying to say, but I don't think I'm too far off. It's a very interesting question, which I don't know the answer to myself. Though I think the need to act in accordance with the truth is something that easily understood. It's easily understood without being religious. Sorry for the ramble. Hopefully this makes the religious talk more understandable. Thank you, I Am Norwegian, for that. That was a good ramble. Now, I would have just stepped on that icon and been like, yeah, it's a picture. It's an icon. It's a little knick-knack. But interesting to know that about Japan's history, that they tried to get rid of all Christians in that way, even with executions. I never knew that. Soma Stars said, for two, what was question number two? Hang on, let me go back and check. Did the prisoner do the right thing, dying instead of renouncing is a religion, that's really up to the reader. Those who don't believe would say the prisoner was foolish for throwing away his life. Those who do believe would say the prisoner was wise because death translated into eternal life. Put me in camp A then, because, yeah, he's just thrown away his life. Absolutely, 100%. You've died for some, even if it is true, like, I still, even if you do believe it, I would still just say, just renounce it, so you don't get killed. Just pretend to, just fake it, you know? Take things too seriously. You know, even if you do believe it and you take it really seriously, just humour them. Yeah, I renounce it. Cool. Yep, can I go? I can go? Cool. And then go and, you know, do a little confession or whatever you got to do, and a few Hail Marys. This is Catholicism, not Christianity, but you know what I mean. Those who do believe would say the prisoner was wise because death translated into eternal life. I don't think, see, if that was what people that were Christians truly believed, then they would just all be on just reckless suicide missions. Like, they would not really care if they lived or died. We've all got our self-preservation intact, though. It doesn't matter how religious you are. Well, actually, I say that, but there are extremes to that, aren't there? Obviously, like your suicide martyrs and bombers and whatever's. Ugh, what a conversation to be having at 1:13 a.m. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, "We can see how Theodore loves controversy and how he enjoys kicking the hornet's nest. If this comes with dessert and cognac, much better." Smerdyakov also loves the opportunity to speak his mind in religious matters, approaching them with a down-to-earth logic that seems affrontful. Juggling with implausible syllogisms, he tries to find a loophole in the situation. His point of view is that a real believer would never deny his faith. So, as we are all not real believers, there is no sense of suffering martyrdom for this, because since we are already lost. Also, denial of faith becomes an ordinary sin, not a special one, because we cannot deny, or we don't know, real faith. And as an ordinary sin, it can be forgiven by grace of God. All this means, for him, that we can deny our faith and save the skin, the soul, and we would never have to suffer martyrdom, sheer sophism. Dirt Burglar said, "There's a fundamental loophole of sorts with Christianity, which was mentioned in the first or second chapter of this book, that literally all sins may be forgiven. So, even from the perspective of a Christian, the soldier could have renounced his faith in order to survive, and that sin would have been forgiven if he later repented. So this decision was definitely wrong from a utilitarian perspective, regardless of whether Christian is true." Hey, that's kind of what I said a minute ago. "I'm reminded of the Great Simpsons episode where Bart learns about confession and God's forgiveness of sin." Alright, that's the conversation about Chapter 7, Book 3, Chapter 7. God, these are not conversations that, I don't know. They're not ones that I would usually participate in. And not because I'm like, I don't know, I just kind of feel like I've had those conversations, you know, and I'm done with those conversations. I've done my time. No more of that. Oh, as I yawn into the next chapter. All right, let's read Book 3, Chapter 8. It's called Over the Brandy. The controversy was over, but strange to say, Fyodor Pavlovich, who had been so gay, suddenly began frowning. He frowned and gulped brandy. And it was already a glass too much. Alright, it's one of those chapters, is it? Okay. So, suddenly began frowning. He frowned and gulped brandy. And it was already a glass too much. "Get along with you, Jesuits," he cried to the servants. "Go away, Smerdyakov. I'll send you the gold piece I promised you today. But be off. Don't cry, Grigory. Go to Marfa. She'll comfort you and put you to bed. The rascals won't let us sit in peace after dinner, he snapped peevishly, as the servants promptly withdrew at his word. Smerdyakov always pokes himself in now after dinner. It's you he's so interested in. What have you done to fascinate him? He added to Ivan. Nothing whatever, answered Ivan. He's pleased to have a high opinion of me. He's a lackey and a mean soul. Raw material for revolution, however, when the time comes. There will be others and better ones, but there will be some like him as well. His kind will come first and better ones after. And when will the time come? The rocket will go off and fizzle out, perhaps. The peasants are not very fond of listening to these supermakers so far. Ah, brother, what a Balaam's ass like that. Thinks and thinks, and the devil knows where he gets to. He's storing up ideas, said Ivan, smiling. You see, I know he can't bear me, nor anyone else, even you, though you fancy that he has a high opinion of you. Worse still with Alyosha, he despises Alyosha. But he doesn't steal, that's one thing, and he's not a gossip. He holds his tongue and doesn't wash our dirty linen in public. That's the same thing three times in a row. He doesn't gossip, he holds his tongue, doesn't wash our dirty linen in public. He makes capital fish pasties too, but damn him, is he worth talking about so much? Of course he isn't. And as for the ideas he may be hatching, the Russian peasant, generally speaking, needs thrashing. That I've always maintained. Our peasants are swindlers and don't deserve to be pitied, and it's a good thing they're still flogged sometimes. Russia is rich in birches. If they destroyed the forests, it would be the ruin of Russia. I stand up for the clever people. We've left off thrashing the peasants. We've grown so clever. But they go on thrashing themselves, and a good thing too, for with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. Or how does it go? Anyhow, it will be measured. But Russia's all swinishness. My dear, if you only knew how I hate Russia, that is not Russia, but all this vice. But maybe I mean Russia. Tout cela c'est de la cochonnerie. All this is filthiness. Do you know what I like? I like wit. You've had another glass. That's enough. Wait a bit. I'll have one more, and then another. Do I really have to hang out with these drunk assholes? Wait a bit. I'll have one more, and then another, and then I'll stop. No, stay. You interrupted me. At Mokro, I was talking to an old man, and he told me there's nothing we like so much as sentencing girls to be thrashed, and we always give the lads the job of thrashing them. And the girl he has thrashed today, the young man will ask in marriage tomorrow, so it quite suits the girls too, he said. There's a set of desardes for you, but it's clever anyway. Shall we go over and have a look at it, eh? Alyosha, are you blushing? Don't be bashful, child. I'm sorry I didn't stay to dinner at the superiors and tell the monks about the girls at Mokro. Alyosha, don't be angry that I offended your superior this morning. I lost my temper. Is no one else speaking? This guy's just like saying, it's just like a one-man conversation. Alyosha, don't be angry that I offended your superior this morning. I lost my temper. If there is a God, if he exists, then of course I am to blame. If there is a God, if he exists, then of course I am to blame, and I shall have to answer for it. But if there isn't a God at all, and he doesn't exist, and there's not one, and he's not there, because there's no God, and God isn't there, what do they deserve, your fathers? It's not enough to cut their heads off, for they keep back progress. Would you believe it, Ivan, that the lacerates my sentiments? No, you don't believe it, as I see from your eyes. I thought he was talking to Alyosha. You believe what people say, that I'm nothing but a buffoon. Alyosha, do you believe that I'm nothing but a buffoon? No, I don't believe it. And I believe you don't, and that you speak the truth. You look sincere and speak sincerely, but not Ivan. Ivan is supercilious. I'd make an end of your monks, though, all the same. I'd take all that mystic stuff and suppress it once and for all. all over Russia so as to bring all the fools to reason, and the gold and the silver that would flow into the mint. But why suppress it? Asked Ivan. The truth may prevail, that's why. Well, if truth were to prevail, you know, you'd be the first to be robbed and suppressed. Ah, I dare say you're right. Ah, I'm an ass, burst out Fyodor Pavlovich, striking himself lightly on the forehead. Well, your monastery may stand then, Alyosha, if that's how it is, and we clever people will sit snug and enjoy our brandy. You know, Ivan, it must have been so ordained by the Almighty himself. Ivan, speak, is there a god or not? Stay, speak the truth, speak seriously, why are you laughing again? I'm laughing that you should have made a clever remark just now about Smerdyakov's belief in the existence of two saints who could move a mountain. Why am I like him now, then? Very much. Well, that shows I'm a Russian too, and I have a Russian characteristic, and you may be caught in the same way, though you are a philosopher. Shall I catch you? What do you bet that I catch you tomorrow? Speak all the same. Is there a god or not? Only be serious. I want you to be serious now. No, there is no god. Oh, yes, sure. Is there a god? There is. Ivan, and is there immortality of some sort? Just a little? Ivan, and is there immortality of some sort? Just a little, just a tiny bit. There is no immortality either. None at all, none at all. There's absolutely nothingness, then. Perhaps there is just something. Anything is better than nothing. Alyosha, is there immortality? God and immortality. God and immortality. In God is immortality. It's more likely Ivan's right. Good Lord, to think what faith, what force of all kinds man has lavished for nothing on that dream. And for how many thousand years? Who is laughing at man, Ivan? For the last time, once and for all, is there a god or not? I ask for the last time. And for the last time there is not. Who is laughing at mankind, Ivan? It must be the devil, said Ivan, smiling. And the devil, does he exist? No, there's no devil either. It's a pity, damn it all. What wouldn't I do to the man who first invented God? Hanging on a bitter aspen tree would be too good for him. There would have been no civilization if they hadn't invented God. Wouldn't there have been? Without God? No, and there would have been no brandy either, but I must take your brandy away from you anyway. Stop, 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 dear boy. One more little glass. I've heard Alyosha's feelings. You're not angry with me, Alyosha, my dear little Alexei. No, I'm not angry. I know your thoughts. Your heart is better than your head. My heart better than my head, is it? Oh, Lord, and that from you, Ivan. Do you love Alyosha? You must love him. Fyodor Pavlovich was by this time very drunk. Listen, Alyosha, I was rude to your elder this morning, but I was excited. But there's a wit in that elder, don't you think, Ivan? Very likely. There is. Il y a du Piron de dedans. There's something of Piron inside of him. He's a Jesuit, a Russian one, that is. As he's an honourable person, there is a hidden indignation boiling within him at having to pretend to and affect holiness. But of course he believes in God. Not a bit of it. Didn't you know? Why, he tells everyone so himself. That is, not everyone, but all the clever people who come to him. He said straight out to Governor Schultz not long ago, credo, but I don't know in what. Really? He really did. But I respect him. There's something of Mephistopheles about him, or rather the hero of our time. Ah, Benin. And what's his name? You see, he's a sensualist. He's such a sensualist that I should be afraid for my daughter when, or my wife, if she went to confess to him. You know, when he begins telling stories, the year before last he invited us to tea with liquor, the ladies sent him liquor, and began telling us about the old times, we nearly split our sides, especially how once cursed a paralyzed woman, if my legs were not bad, I know a dance I could dance you, he said. What do you say to that? I've plenty of tricks in my time, said he. He did dem e dove, the merchant out of 60,000. I've got no idea who's even talking at this point. What, he stole it? He brought him the money, as a man he could trust, saying, take care of it for me, friend. There'll be a police search at my place tomorrow. And he kept it. You have given it to the church, he declared. I said to him, "You're a scoundrel." I said, "No." He said, "No," he said, "I'm not a scoundrel, but I'm a broad-minded." But that wasn't he, that was someone else. I've muddled him with someone else, without noticing it. "Come, another glass, and that's enough. Take away the bottle, Ivan. I've been telling lies. Why didn't you stop me, Ivan, and tell me I was lying? I knew you'd stop yourself." "That's a lie. You did it from spite, from simple spite against me. You despise me. You have come to me and despised me in my own house." "Well, I'm going away. You've had too much brandy. I've begged you for Christ's sake to go to Chesmyshire for a day or two, and you don't go. I'll go tomorrow, if you're so set upon it." "You won't go. You want to keep an eye on me. That's what you want, spiteful fellow. That's why you won't go," the old man persisted. He had reached that state of drunkenness when the drunkard, who has till then been inoffensive, tries to pick a quarrel and to assert himself. "Why are you looking at me? Why do you look like that? Your eyes look at me and say, 'You ugly drunkard.' Your eyes are mistrustful, they're contemptuous. You've come here with some design." Alyosha here looks at me and his eyes shine. Alyosha doesn't despise me. "Alexei, you mustn't love Ivan." "Don't be ill-tempered with my brother. Leave off attacking him," Alyosha said emphatically. "Oh, all right. Ah, my head aches. Take away the brandy, Ivan. It's the third time I've told you." He mused, and suddenly a slow, cunning grin spread over his face. "Don't be angry with a feeble old man, Ivan. I know you don't love me, but don't be angry all the same. You've nothing to love for. You go to Chemeshna. I'll come to you myself and bring you a present. I'll show you a little wench there. I've had my eye on her a long time. She's still running from about barefoot. Don't be afraid of barefooted wenches. Don't despise them, they're pearls." And he kissed his hand with a smack. "To my thinking," he revived at once, seeming to grow sober the instant he touched on his favourite topic, "to my thinking, ah, you boys, you children, little suckling pigs, to my thinking, I never thought a woman ugly in my life. That's been my rule. Can you understand that? How could you understand it? You've milk in your veins, not blood. You're not out of your shells yet. My rule has been that way, that you can always find something devilishly interesting in every woman that you wouldn't find in any other. Only one must know how to find it. That's the point. That's the talent. To my mind, there are no ugly women. The fact that she is a woman is half the battle. But how could you understand that? Even in Veal's Phyllis, even in them, you may discover something that makes you simply wonder that men have been such fools as to let them grow old without noticing them. Barefooted girls, or unattractive ones, you must take by surprise. Didn't you know that? You must astound them till they are fascinated, upset, ashamed that such a gentleman would fall in love with such a little slut. It's a jolly good thing that there always are and will be masters and slaves in the world, so that there always will be a little maid of all work and her master, and you know, that's all that's needed for happiness. Stay, listen, Alyosha. I always used to surprise your mother, but in a different way. I paid no attention to her at all, but all at once, when the minute came, I'd be all devotion to her, crawl on my knees, kiss her feet, and I always, I remember it is as though it were today, reduce her to that tinkling, quiet, nervous, queer little laugh. It was peculiar to her. I knew her attacks always used to begin like that. The next day she would begin shrieking hysterically, and this little laugh was not a sign of delight, though it made a very good counterfeit. That's the great thing, to know how to take everyone. Once Belyakovsky, he was a handsome fellow and rich, used to like to come here and hang around her, suddenly gave me a slap in the face in her presence, and she, such a mild sheep, why I thought she would have knocked me down for that blow. How she set on me. "You're beaten now, she said. You've taken a blow from him. You have been trying to sell me to him, she said. And how dared he strike you in my presence? Don't dare come again near me, never, never. Run at once, challenging him to a duel. I took her to a monastery, then to bring her to her senses. The Holy Fathers prayed her back to reason, but I swear by God Alyosha, I never insulted the poor crazy girl once, only once, perhaps in the first year. Then she was very fond of praying. She used to keep the feats of Our Lady particularly and used to turn me out of her room then. I'll knock that mysticism out of her, I thought. Here, said I, so you see your holy image? Here it is. Here, I take it down. You believe it's miraculous, but here, I'll spit on it directly and nothing will happen to me for it. When he saw it, good Lord, I thought she would kill me. But she only jumped up, wrung her hands, then suddenly hid her face in them, began trembling all over, and fell on the floor. Fell all of a heap. Alyosha, Alyosha, what's the matter? The old man jumped up in alarm. From the time he had begun speaking about his mother, a change had gradually come over Alyosha's face. He flushed crimson, his eyes glowed, his lips quivered. The old sot had gone spluttering on, noticing nothing, till the moment when something very strange happened to Alyosha. Precisely what he was describing in the crazy woman was suddenly repeated with Alyosha. He jumped up from his seat exactly as his mother was said to have done, wrung his hands, hid his face in them, and fell back in his chair, shaking all over in a hysterical paroxysm of sudden, violent, silent weeping. His extraordinary resemblance to his mother particularly impressed the old man. Ivan, Ivan, water, quickly. It's like her, exactly as she used to be, this. Then, his mother. Spurt some water on him from your mouth, that's what I used to do to her. He's upset about his mother. His mother, he muttered to Ivan. But she was my mother too, I believe, his mother. Was she not? Said Ivan, with uncontrolled anger and contempt. The old man shrank before his eyes, but something very strange had happened. Though only for a second it seemed really to have escaped the old man's mind that Alyosha's mother suddenly was the mother of Ivan too. Your mother, he muttered, not understanding. What do you mean? What mother are you talking about? Was she? Why, damn it, of course she was yours too. Damn it, my mind has never been so darkened before. Excuse me, why I was thinking, Ivan, he stopped. A broad, drunken, half-senseless grin overspread his face. At the moment a fearful voice and clamour was heard in the hall. There were violent shouts, the door was flung open, Dmitri burst into the room. The old man rushed to Ivan in terror. He'll kill me, he'll kill me, don't let him get at me, he screamed, clinging to the shirt of Ivan's coat. All right, there we go, another chapter down. That was book 3, chapter 8. I don't know what to say, guys. That's maybe some of the worst writing I've ever read. I'm going to put this up there with Corey Taylor's book. Corey Taylor is the singer from Slipknot. He's often, if you ever ask, like, if ever I get asked, like, what's the worst book? Not that I even get asked that, but that is, for me, the worst book ever written. Corey Taylor's book. Well, I think he's written a few, but he had one that was just condescending from start to finish, and it was a terrible, terrible book. But, I don't know, this is giving it a run for its money. This is certainly makes a lot less sense than Corey Taylor's book. The writing is more pretentious than Corey Taylor's book. It's far, far more boring than Corey Taylor's book. Might be the worst book I've ever read. Might be. I hope you're liking it. I mean, it's kind of a nothing thing to say at this point, because I'm clearly not doing anything to help you enjoy it. And I do, trust me when I say I do feel bad if I'm ruining this book for anyone. But I don't know, I just can't even pretend there's any merit to it. It's like, what's the good... People keep saying, like, the characters are so deep and... That's like the cliche thing to say about Dostoevsky, and I think with Notes from Underground, I saw a bit of that. I saw some good depth to the characters. And it was like he knew someone with a mental illness, or like with a, you know, not a mental illness, but like, you know, something like mental health problems, I should say. Mental health problem. And he observed the way they acted and wrote about it. And it was pretty good. It was, I thought it was pretty cool. But this, I can't really find depth to any of the characters. They just babble. They all just babble. Babble, babble, babble. Like, why is Fyodor right? Like, that chapter was 90% him just talking, but it wasn't a conversation. It was just him talking. I can't picture it, you know? I can't picture a guy just sitting there and saying those things to someone else. And the other, what's the other person doing all that time? And the sentences, it's like a paragraph. It's like there's no paragraphs. It's just a jumble of sentences, and some match up with others and others don't, and then there's a random one, and then there's one that relates to something from the previous paragraph, and I just can't follow it. So the questions I'm going to ask is, what was this chapter about? I didn't take any of it in. Sorry. And hopefully someone can just summarize it or something for me. But, I don't know. I mean, it's really frustrating because I'm 450 days into this project. And it's finally got to the point. Like, I've enjoyed all of it, nearly all of it. Even the books I didn't really love. But now with this one, it's just like, it's getting to the point where once I get to, like, the reading bit of the podcast, I have this feeling like, I don't actually want to read it for the first time. So, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you guys. It's a shit book. This is a shit book. It's a bad book. And I also have this feeling like, I don't understand how I'm the only one. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I'm going crazy over here. Like, everyone's saying it's a good book, and I can't even find a bit of merit in the book. And I don't know. It's that Will Ferrell thing, you know, in Zoolander. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Because I could understand if it was like a divided, like people were divided on or about the book, and some people loved it, some people didn't. But it's like, I'm pretty sure I'm like the only person who's seeing it this way. But for me, it's so extremely bad that I don't see how anyone could not see it that way. So, I don't know. I'm confused. I'm so confused. Anyway, that's the podcast for today. Thanks for listening. I'm sorry I'm a dick. I love you guys. I appreciate you sitting through my grumpiness. hopefully, I'll see you tomorrow.